Hello, you're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins, and I'm Bobby Jane Apostolos. Details on our backgrounds in threat intelligence and cybersecurity can be found in the podcast bio. Although all three of our participants today do work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Welcome to our creative world of Gossip Int.
So we've just spent the last 12 episodes talking about structured analytic techniques, and hopefully our listeners got as much out of it as my mom did.
Oh, your mom listens to the podcast? That's really cute, Bobby Jane.
Oh my God, yes. My mom is obsessed with me. She really thinks I'm the cat's meow, you know? But also, our format and using the techniques in celebrity-based scenarios to help explain concepts really helps her grasp the core techniques that we're trying to cover here. This week, we are making a shift from structured analytic techniques to mindsets and biases. So Karen, can you help us explain to our listeners why we are making this pivot and what we can learn from them?
Yeah, and I think this part might be a little easier for some people to grasp. When we started off with structured analytic techniques, in some ways, it was doing things in reverse. We were identifying a cure without always identifying the disease. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about that disease. Structured analytic techniques are meant to address and mitigate the effects of mindsets and biases. We mentioned a few of them in the past episodes.
So I meant to tell you guys, I loved the Bigfoot episode. And obviously the one with Hilaria Baldwin. They're kind of neck to neck as my favorites.
I have a friend who's absolutely obsessed with Hilaria as well. And I can't wait to hear what she thought of that episode in particular. She talks to me about it all the time. She is up to date on the Reddit threads. What we see from that is that these episode topics, they end up overlapping. We can talk about a faked pregnancy, and at the time we were talking about applying it to Beyonce, but now we can also apply it to Hilaria or other celebrities. But regarding why we want to learn more about mindsets and biases in the context of critical thinking, a lot of the biases we're going to discuss are driven by what we will call heuristics. Heuristics are mental shortcuts that ease our cognitive load during information processing. Okay, that sounds kind of intense and arcane, right? What does it mean practically? It means that if I see a furry animal trying to get into my garbage can at night, my brain automatically tells me it's a raccoon. They're not called trash pandas for nothing.
I love trash pandas. Did I ever tell you guys that my ex-mother-in-law actually kept them in her house? I mean, she always say like she was rescuing them. Yeah, I'm using quote fingers. But like, seriously, people, do not keep trash pandas in your house.
I 100% would definitely have a raccoon pet, but only if it was trained since birth. In my scenario, however, if I were to turn the light on, what if it's actually a monkey that escaped from the zoo that's in my trash? Most times our mental shortcut will be right. 999 times out of 1,000, it's going to be a raccoon. But that 1 in 1,000 times, it won't be.
So this is super automatic and a process that happens quickly and subconsciously?
Exactly. Evolution has taught my brain how to make snap decisions about when something is dangerous or not. A small raccoon in my trash, not dangerous. Giant bear in my trash, dangerous. Our brains develop heuristics in order to speed up certain processes, but they can also cause us to make mistakes or develop cognitive biases. For example, stereotyping is actually a type of heuristic. I think many of us assume that pineapples grow on trees because we have the stereotype that fruit grows on trees. But in fact, pineapples grow from spiky shrubs. Assuming all fruits grow on trees is a harmless stereotype, but we all know how pernicious stereotyping can be among human groups.
Yeah, I think everyone can kind of regrettably recall believing or applying a stereotype in their life. I know that I grew up with several misguided stereotypes in my mind, and I've had to really work hard at reversing that thinking. So I can see how heuristics is really a hardwired processing component of our brain. So what exactly are we learning today?
Today and in the next few episodes, we're going to unpack some specific cognitive biases and talk about how they impact us. I want to stress that while the term bias carries a negative connotation in our popular lexicon, we all have these biases, and so we shouldn't necessarily think of them as some terrible blemish, but rather as small and natural blind spots. As I just mentioned, we are all pre-programmed to use heuristics and experience other processing errors. This means we all develop cognitive biases. The question is how well we're able to overcome them.
Okay, so that's a great point. These can be overcome. Being aware of them is definitely the first step. But with effort and time, these can be addressed. And I 100% agree. So cognitive biases, go.
There are many scientific definitions of what a cognitive bias is. I'd like us to use something simple and graspable. We're going to define it simply as an accidental analytic distortion when interpreting information.
I don't think simply means what you think it means.
I don't know if I can go any simpler than that. We'll just have to explain it through context. There are all kinds of biases, not all of which are derived from heuristics, although many are. These biases affect things like decision-making, judgment, and memory. While we all experience differences in our susceptibility to biases, through what's called debiasing training, we can diminish this susceptibility and develop cognitive flexibility.
I love when you refer to our brain activity as something that you can exercise or train. I see these conversations and discussions popping up all across the industries, and I think it's great.
If we can train a goldfish to do tasks, we can totally train our brains. And in fact, that plasticity is essential to combat cognitive decline in old age. Sudoku, logic problems, my mom does all of them. And it's for a reason. Well, okay, it's because she loves them, but also it will help her later on. But that's another conversation. Cognitive biases are a popular area of research, and the list of cognitive biases is constantly growing. Even a quick Google search shows a list of 50 of the most common cognitive biases. And if those are only the most common, you know that there's a lot more than that. In fact, there are at least 180 recognized biases.
Whoa.
Right? According to the Cognitive Biases Codex, these biases fall along four axes. One, how we analyze information. Examples of this include that we remember things that stand out over the mundane, or things we're already primed to notice. We also notice big changes or information that confirms our existing beliefs. Two, how we remember information. Examples of this include our tendency to discard specifics in favor of generalities and modify our memories after an event. Three, how we make decisions. Examples of this include favoring simple options over complex ones and maintaining group cohesion. We also commit to sunk costs when we shouldn't and behave overconfidently. And finally, four, how we fill in the blanks. Examples of this include assuming we know what other people are thinking and looking for patterns in data.
Okay, wow. So when you first said 180, I was like, oh my gosh, what else may I subconsciously be doing or thinking that may be negative? I think I just automatically assumed that these were all negative, but some of these seem to be pretty important across the board and instrumental to our success and being effective in our everyday life. So which cognitive bias are we specifically talking about today? I assume we aren't doing 180 in 30 minutes.
Fun fact, American rapper Twista is the Guinness World Record holder for fastest English language rapper with a crazy speed of almost 11 syllables per second. But since Twista is not given this presentation, no, we can't do all 180 biases. Instead, today we're going to talk about confirmation bias. I chose confirmation bias as our first in this series of cognitive biases because it's so pervasive and can be so harmful. Confirmation bias is our tendency to look for, interpret, remember, and use information in a way that confirms or supports our pre-existing beliefs or ideas. It falls in the category of information processing biases. So let's say you and I are having an argument about whether trickle-down or pump-priming economics is better. Put another way, is it better to give tax breaks to the rich and to businesses so that they buy and produce more, thereby growing the economy? Or is it better to give those tax breaks to the middle and lower classes so they can buy more and grow the economy? This is a classic federal economic policy divide between Republicans and Democrats.
Oh my gosh, I wish we all agreed on what the answer to that is. I don't want to get fired up, so Karen, please go on.
To support our positions, we'd each go and research our side and come back with the best evidence, but we would both be cherry-picking our evidence. We would purposely not look up the evidence against our position. In the course of our research, we might become even more confident in our position. Look at all this evidence we have. And now we're better prepared for the next time this topic comes up in conversation. But what we would have done is engaged in confirmation bias. Most likely, I'd list my arguments and tune you out while you gave yours. And you'd do the same to me. All we would have done was strengthened our own bias.
Yeah, so that sounds like the classic beginning of a social media argument.
Absolutely. This is a huge problem on social media right now. Confirmation bias occurs when we choose information that supports what we already believe and ignore contrary or ambiguous evidence. And as we all know, just from experience, the effect is strongest for emotionally charged issues. For example, politics or religion.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys grow up with that we don't discuss politics and religion at the table type rule? Growing up, I didn't realize why it was such a big deal. I mean, I do know why it is now. I understand why we don't do it. But since technically I was never allowed to have those conversations, I didn't see that firsthand, the why. Do you think more people are essentially victims of this bias than not?
Oh boy, that's a complex answer. And I'll leave it at, people aren't inclined to change their mind at dinner and will resent anyone's attempts to do it. I'm not saying we shouldn't have those conversations, but you know, it's not really going to change anyone's minds. There are three subcategories of confirmation bias: biased search for information, biased interpretation of information, and biased recall of information. These are pretty self-evident, so I won't go into them further. But to your question, I think at the dinner table, people aren't particularly excited about being an unbiased interpreter of information, just as the person delivering that information isn't biased. My father-in-law, we keep having the same conversation because he's not listening to what I'm saying. And obviously, I'm right, so he really should listen to me.
Yeah, I'm getting anxiety about that, covering the family holidays. Conversations, yes, they can get really heated, but I kind of want to believe that people have the best intentions, you know?
Something I want to point out about confirmation bias is that to some extent, it's not our fault. According to social psychologist Robert McCune, most biased evidence processing is a result of cognitive and motivated influences. So for example, it's hard for us to process complex information. As a result, we unconsciously apply heuristics to it or to reduce an issue to the most basic parts. According to social psychologist Ziva Kunda, motivation creates the bias, but cognitive factors determine the size of the effect. That's good news and bad news, because while we might struggle to combat our own motivations, we can work on the cognitive part.
Okay. Well, good. So that provides a glimmer of hope that one can be aware of and make conscious efforts to correct the biases. So Karen, let's move to my personal favorite part. Tell us about our pop culture topic of the day.
Bobby Jane, do you know who the most prolific serial killer in the world is?
Ooh, pop quiz. I got to go with Ted Bundy.
Not even close. He's not even the most prolific American serial killer. According to Wikipedia, it's Luis Garavito. Garavito was active in the 1990s in Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela. Called La Bestia, the Beast, he confessed to killing 140 boys, but is suspected to have killed over 300. Fun fact, originally sentenced to over 1,800 years in prison, the sentence was later reduced to 22 years, and he's eligible for parole next year, which is terrifying. Also, fun fact, the Wikipedia page on serial killers is a fantastic way to spend an hour.
Oh my God, yes. I'm sure we are not alone in our fascination with serial killers. So many rabbit holes, so many conversations in my household where people are like, their eyes are glazing over. Okay, but how does this tie back to the confirmation bias that we're talking about today?
This has actually to do with how Americans view serial killers. In the 1970s, FBI special agents Bob Ressler and John Douglas set out to interview 36 incarcerated serial killers in an effort to understand them. Interviewees included famous killers like Charles Manson, David Berkowitz, aka the Son of Sam, John Wayne Gacy, and Ed Kemper. Using the information from the interviews, Ressler and Douglas came up with a general profile for serial killers. In short, the average killer was a white male in his mid-20s to 30s from a middle or lower class background. So-called organized killers were of average or above average intelligence, married or in a relationship, employed, and educated. Disorganized killers, on the other hand, were normally below average in intelligence and possibly mentally ill. They often came from a dysfunctional family and were abused as children. Many killers had poor relations with their mothers, an absent father, and a history of sexual dysfunction that made them lash out at women. This template has become highly popularized in pop culture. On Netflix right now, for example, there are documentaries on Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, and John Wayne Gacy. Ask someone to describe a serial killer, and this is pretty much the description you'll get: a creepy, loner white man in his late 20s or 30s who hates women.
Oh my God, Jeffrey Dahmer is trending so hard right now. I don't even know how I feel about that. Like, the affinity people have just towards him following that Netflix video.
Yeah, and I feel like some of that might even have to do with casting. Like the Ted Bundy one, for example, you put Zac Efron, the heartthrob of all young women from, you know, High School Musical, and you cast him as a serial killer. I was even at a comedy club this weekend, and at least two of the comedians had jokes about Dahmer. One of them joking about how he didn't really care what Dahmer did, just how attractive he was.
Yeah. Okay. Ew. There does seem to be a growth along that fine line between fascination and affinity towards serial killers. But like you said, Karen, these are young white men who literally hate women, right?
Not exactly. It turns out if you interview a bunch of white guys who were caught before their mid-30s, the profile that you'll come up with is, wait for it, young white guys. Now, it is true that over 90% of serial killers are men, but it's the other stuff that's not quite right. According to the Radford University, Florida Gulf Coast University serial killer database, only 12% of U.S. serial killers fit the profile of being a white male in his mid or late 20s. Only 53% of killers are white, for example, while only 27% are in their mid to late 20s. If we look only at the period from 1990 to 2016, only 8% of killers are white men in their mid to late 20s. In addition, 70% of killers reported not having been abused as children. So already we see that that original profile is breaking down. And by the way, sidebar, per that same data, the answer to the question, how many serial killers are active in the US, is that in 2015, there were 15. So that's fun.
I am loving the fun facts today. But to circle us back, what does this have to do with confirmation bias?
The original so-called serial killer profile isn't entirely wrong. It does fit some killers. For example, it was generally applicable to Ted Bundy. But we have a problem. As a result of the popularization of the stereotype, every time we hear of a white male killer, it reinforces our perception of what a serial killer looks like. Dennis Rader, known as the BTK killer, Gary Ridgway, the Green River killer, and Joseph DeAngelo, the Golden State killer, were all white men. We look at their pictures and think, yep, that's a serial killer. And when Hollywood creates serial killers like Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs or Joe Goldberg on the Netflix show You, that stereotype becomes reinforced. But that confirmation bias causes trouble when we don't recognize the limitations of that template. What happens if the serial killer isn't a young white guy? Will we be able to recognize and stop him? And that's a problem because it draws out the time to capture and it means more people could die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I know where this is going now.
Yeah, and here's an example. In October 2002, a gunman began a spree of attacks in Maryland, the District of Columbia, and Virginia, killing 10 people. Multiple criminal profilers of varying backgrounds jumped into the fray to offer their opinion. The so-called Beltway Sniper, or DC Sniper, was deemed likely to be a white man in his 20s or 30s. He had a regular job and was going on his rampage on the weekends. In the absence of information, these profilers fell back on familiar stereotypes. But when the killer was apprehended, it turned out it was not one killer, but two. John Allen Muhammad was 41, and his accomplice, Leboy Malvo, was 17. They were on a 10-month murder and robbery spree that started back in Washington State. They weren't just weekend snipers. And they were Black. Years of confirmation bias of law enforcement or criminologists hearing reports in press about young white serial killers led to these experts thinking that the killer must fit a certain profile. But years of research subsequent to Ressler and Douglas's interviews has shown the limitations of that original profile. Unfortunately, it's hard to undo years of pop culture influence. Ask any American who they think the worst serial killer in history is, and they might say Bundy or Gacy or even H.H. Holmes because they've heard those names. By the way, if you haven't heard Holmes, he's the first recognized American serial killer. Again, there's also a thing on Netflix about him. Or, like you, Bobby Jane, they say Ted Bundy. But per that same Wikipedia page of serial killers, the first American isn't even until number 9 on that list, behind men from South America, Pakistan, Russia, India, and China. Serial killing isn't a white man problem, and it's not even an American problem. Mass murderers and serial killers are everywhere. The US just has the resources to detect and imprison them, which is creepy. So creepy. And also, it's not a modern phenomenon either. Guy de Ré was believed to have killed about 100 young boys in France, and Elizabeth Bathory, who other people might have heard of. So again, it's not always limited by gender, it's not limited by time, and it's not limited by location. And a final note, the problem of bias in criminal profiling isn't limited just to serial killers. After the 1996 Atlanta Olympics bombing, security officer Richard Jewell, the man who found the bomb, was persecuted by the FBI under the belief that he fit the profile of a lone bomber, which was colloquially called the frustrated white man profile. In point of fact, Jewell didn't actually fit, but the real bomber, white supremacist Eric Rudolph, did.
A sidebar, I do recall there was a Black male serial killer in Los Angeles. I believe he was called the Grim Sleeper. And I know he was targeting Black women sex workers. He was famously known for not being known. And as terrible that it is, I know that one could easily make the assumption that we don't really hear about it due to who the targets were. So what I think I'm gathering is the media heavily influences our personal biases. But then I kind of have to acknowledge law enforcement's part in that, right? Okay, so let's pivot to our technology example. Thank you so much, Karen. Hopefully I didn't get completely distracted by this. Caitlin, what do you have for us today with our technology topic?
So today on the tech side, a really key and current issue is confirmation bias, but in how people consume news media, particularly those who read news via smartphones and social media.
Okay, so wait, that is extremely specific. How does social media tie into this? I just started getting into TikTok. Yes, I'm old, listeners, you can come for me later. But please don't tell me I have to get off TikTok. I mean, I definitely don't use it to get my news. But can people be affected by confirmation biases no matter what their source is?
Yeah, most definitely, Bobby Jane. And that's an issue that everyone should be aware of. But there are a few reasons that cognitive bias may affect people who get their news from social media in a way that's much greater than what would happen in traditional media. Until Facebook and other social media apps were popularized, people got their news mainly from newspapers, television, and/or radio, what we would basically call traditional media. Stories reported in traditional media are not only fact-checked and generally written by people with degrees in journalism and communication, unlike what's on social media, but they're also pushed to listeners and readers in a different way than stories on social media.
Yeah, I do miss the OGs of 60 Minutes. Those guys were the best.
Very old school. Anyway, a newscast, whether on the radio or TV, is split into segments like news, weather, and sports. Newspapers are segmented in a very similar way. So when someone sits down for dinner and pops on the 6 o'clock news, they're getting information of all types. Someone not interested in sports generally doesn't turn off TV when that segment is on. They sit through it so they can find out whether it's going to be sunny out tomorrow or not in the next segment. The news isn't all doom and gloom. But news from social media isn't exactly like that. It's not really broken into themes. So consumers are less likely to get a more holistic version of the news. And as we know, they're likely to get a very distorted picture of the news, which we'll discuss in a minute.
Yes, I completely agree with this. People do not get your news from social media.
Facebook news not offering the latest baseball stats isn't really the big problem here. The problem is multifold. I just mentioned the idea of vetting in traditional media. Newspapers or TV stations don't want to publish inaccurate news because they risk being sued for it. But inaccurate information, what is often termed fake news, proliferates all over social media. No one is held accountable for it. So for example, if CNN reports that a certain politician had a stroke, we can trust that that's true. And in fact, we'll start to see other news outlets pick up that story and run with it, so we can verify that. But if there's a news story that appears on Facebook that says a certain politician is taking money from Russian mobsters, we should immediately be skeptical. If no other news source is reporting it, it's probably a lie.
Yeah. There are some wild things that are being passed around on social media. And I personally know folks who seem to be really susceptible to false or misleading information. It's almost like they want the information to be true rather than wanting to know if it's true.
Exactly, Bobby Jane. Where we get ourselves into trouble is that if we already believe bad things about a politician, we're more likely to believe that news story. We know it's not coming from CNN, but it aligns with our pre-existing notions, so we accept it as true. Right here, our confirmation bias is stopping us from doing a good job of assessing the source of the information, and we're reinforcing what we already believe, even if the source is dubious. We've fallen right into an information trap.
1,000%.
But another thing to consider is, why did that fraudulent news story appear in our Facebook feed anyway? Facebook uses algorithms to learn the preferences of users. It then caters to what it determines that the user's interests are. What that means, basically in simpler terms, is that Facebook is telling us what we want to hear. It's pushing content to us that reinforces our pre-existing beliefs. If, for example, you're a Republican, it will give you pro-Republican news. If you're a Democrat, it will give you pro-Democrat news. But Facebook doesn't do a really great job of vetting things. Facebook is a conduit for information, and it can't fact-check every posting and every article. As a result, we get all sorts of content of quite questionable accuracy sent to us, including conspiracy theories, clickbait, hyperpartisan content, and even pseudoscience. And that applies to all political orientations, both liberal and conservative. And while Facebook gets a bad reputation for doing this, it really is all social media applications and sites. TikTok does the same thing when they tailor the types of videos shown to you. That's why they call it the For You page.
Whew, this is a little overwhelming, Caitlin.
I'm sorry, but it's not that traditional media doesn't carry a bias. Everyone knows, for example, that Fox News is very right-wing, while MSNBC leans left. But at least there is some effort, albeit kind of a decreasing one, to show some equality in reporting. This new age of algorithms, however, excludes any sense of balance and impartiality and reinforces the worst aspects of sectarianism. This is called attitude polarization, and it really is only getting worse. Unfortunately, we're terrible at detecting fake news when it aligns with our beliefs. According to a study, 56% of Facebook users can't recognize fake headlines if they're consistent with their own beliefs. And 86% of internet users report having been deceived by so-called fake news. So this means that we're being radicalized by fraudulent news.
Okay. So like I said, very overwhelming. It makes me even more concerned for some folks that are very close to me in my life. So I want to believe there is a way out of this. What can people do to combat this, Caitlin?
So here's where the structured analytic techniques and critical thinking part of our podcast come back into play. One of the things that researchers have found is when attempting to understand an issue, we develop a hypothesis and then attempt to confirm it. This means we're working to prove our idea rather than disprove it. But we'll actually be more effective if we seek to refute our own hypothesis. This is called falsification. And what that means is that, for example, let's say I was looking at the issue of gun control. Rather than trying to prove my beliefs right, I should challenge myself to prove my beliefs wrong. This causes me to be more open in taking in competing evidence and alternative ideas. Now, this doesn't mean I can totally overcome my confirmation bias just through falsification. Plenty of studies have shown that I'll continue to cling to my original ideas, but it may lessen my attachment to them. Another thing we can do is create multiple hypotheses. The more ideas we have, the more we can seek to align evidence with them. Research has shown that when people who develop at least three hypotheses are more likely to correctly identify mistakes when performing analysis than those who develop just one hypothesis. And in the event of something like a mistake, the more plausible hypotheses that we can come up with, the higher likelihood that the cause of a mistake will be identified. And as a final note, a study by Charles Lord, Mark Lepper, and Elizabeth Preston in 1984 found that a good way to combat confirmation bias was through a consider the opposite strategy. Study participants were told to ask themselves at each step of evaluating a study whether they would have reached the same conclusion had the study produced results contradictory to where they are now. So, for example, they were shown research that indicated the death penalty lowered murder rates. They were asked to analyze the study's methodology and imagine that it didn't lower murder rates. The study suggests that we perform best when given a strategy to help us overcome our natural tendency towards confirmation bias. This is good news, bad news. Good news is that there are mitigation strategies we can follow. Bad news is that the vast majority of people will never use them, and attitude polarization will continue.
Well, I feel slightly reassured, a little bit, from my personal perspective and in combating it. But hopefully, folks, they know the information. The idea is that they do something about it.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to help with. So ultimately, clicks on social media equal financial gain for someone. Companies and even regular news outlets use clickbaity titles for articles to attract people to click into them and drive ad revenue. Titles like Why People Are Renouncing Ambition in the Workplace, a title used by Time this month, or Jury Announces Whether Parkland School Shooter Should Live or Die, are here to stay. While some may sound innocuous, we should really be careful to remember that the more inflammatory and outlandish a title, the more likely it's fake.
Well, thank you so much, Caitlin. As we end our episode this week, I was curious, do either of you have close people in your life that are stuck in their own little echo chamber?
Yeah, most definitely. I 100% have family members that listen to one news source and one news source only. They'll constantly project those ideas and those beliefs onto others, even though they haven't really taken in any other perspective.
I do too. I mentioned my father-in-law and some of his beliefs that we clash over and my inability to get through to him, but even my own parents. Interestingly enough, they genuinely believe that Hillary Clinton had people murdered. And my parents aren't the only ones that believe that. But I think we should also remember that these beliefs that people can hold aren't necessarily just limited to politics. We can often find ourselves in a sort of echo chamber with beliefs that could be totally unrelated to politics or religion. It could be something absolutely ridiculous. I can think back growing up to all of the food studies that were done and how there was constant debate. Are eggs bad for cholesterol? Are they okay for cholesterol? Is chocolate bad? Is chocolate good? It is easy for us to hit a certain point where we say, I read a study back in the whenever, and now I believe it.
Oh, I hear you. And that trash pandas make good pets. I definitely see that out there. All right, guys. Well, that wraps up today's episode on confirmation bias. We hope that you got some good information out of it, and maybe we're even slightly entertained. In our next episode, we will be talking about the Dunning-Kruger effect. And yeah, I have no idea what that is. And I'll bet a few of you don't either. So it should make for a great episode. Thank you for listening and join us next time on Gossip Inn.